This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The first 5 years are the most important in terms of shaping a child's brain. We're all born with different gifts, but how well we'll be able to live and learn depends in part on the nutrition and stimulation we get as little ones. So today we continue our series on kids with a look at the best ways parents and caregivers can develop their child's brain. In a few minutes, we'll speak to a psychology professor about the impact of culture and environment on brain development. But right now, we have Annapurna Trout, the chairperson for the Department of Neurology at Howard University Hospital. She also serves as the director of pediatric neurology at Howard University Hospital. Plus, Areva Martin. She's a civil litigation lawyer who specializes in disability law and special education. She's also the co-founder and president of the Special Needs Network. It provides services to families with disabled children in underserved communities. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning. Welcome.
So, Dr. Trout, let me start with you. When does the brain start developing?
Almost from day one, when the cells start to differentiate in an early embryo, you find that a certain group of cells which are going to form the brain, the neuroblasts, line themselves up and form a streak, and then they dip in, form a tube, and around this tube you found that it's a lot of cells that divide and subdivide, and the division of these cells, the neurons, which are going to form the neurons, you know, that is the formation of the brain. The brain produces about 200 billion cells, you know, many more than an adult has. And unless there's proper connectivity, some of those cells kind of die off, because if they don't connect well, then they don't stay in the brain system. And the brain actually is about 25% of the size of an adult brain in a newborn baby. By the time you're about 3 years old, you're almost the size of the brain size is almost the size of an adult brain. So there's a very rapid development of the brain, you know, in the first, particularly the first 3 years of life.
You know, over the past decades, people have changed their ideas about what intelligence is and, you know, how people develop skills and whether they're gifted and et cetera. But how is it that some people can get more stimulation than others in ways that help their brain? I mean, isn't it a situation where you can have a child who's born and they could become very different depending on the environment and the nutrition that they get?
Absolutely. You know, there's not only environment that plays a role, the genes play a role, but the environment and the gene interaction is very, very important, and that can change the gene function. The environment can change gene function and how the brain develops and the synaptic connections in the brain. So I think there's a big interaction that is occurring. And around that is the social and the emotional factors that are important in the development of the child. So the nurturing of a child is just as important and can even alter genes, you know, because that's part of the environment in a growing child. So I think there's a lot of factors here that are involved when a baby is growing, and the maximum stimulation that really should be given to a child is in those first 3 years of development.
What is it that's so important about the first 3 years?
That is when the brain is growing maximally. The brain is almost like a sponge. It absorbs everything that can be given to the brain. Now, once you do not really intervene during these first 3 years, then people have shown in studies that the brain actually is a smaller brain. And even in animal studies, it's been shown. Animals that are in the wild have a much bigger brain than animals that have been brought up in captivity. So you find the human child is just the same. You know, if you have a child who's not nurtured, nobody talks to the child is not really socially stimulated, then the brain size can actually be smaller than what a normal brain would be. And with the size, you have the connections in the brain, the so-called synapses. So these synapses, it's very important that stimulation really, you know, the brain is plastic, and stimulation really kind of channels where these connections will occur. And it is the circuitry in the brain, how the cells are connected, how many thousands of neurons are interconnected, you know, that really tells us how a person will grow and think and socially adjust himself and be a value to society.
Let me bring you in, Ariva. You are someone who clearly values education, is very accomplished, very successful, mother of three. When you had your first two children specifically, and we'll get to your third child in a second, what did you do to try to make sure that they were getting what they needed to grow healthy and to maximize their potential?
Basically, the social interaction piece that the doctor talked about, I found that was critically, critically important to the development of my two girls. So getting them to the library, reading them books, taking them out into the community, introducing them to different people, to arts, to music, and really, as the doctor indicated, stimulating their minds, trying to engage them. I found that that was really important to their development. And today, my teenage daughter is an avid, avid reader. She reads the New York Times ferociously. She knows every fact that's ever been printed in the New York Times. And my husband and I know that that's attributable to the time we took as a child with her, really engaging her in the reading process.
Well, what was one of the fun moments, and there are always fun moments with kids, where you just saw them getting something. You saw them, you know, that something clicked in and they got a new skill when they were little.
Well, I think for me, with my girls in particular, it was the independence. You start to notice that your children don't rely on you as much for things that, you know, they had become so accustomed to relying on you for. So I saw my girls start to, you know, move away from my husband and I and to take steps and to start to really think on their own, to start piecing together what had been taught to them, you know, as preschoolers and as toddlers.
Let me turn back to you, Dr. Trout. I mean, it sounds as if, you know, simply from the tone of your voice, you're very excited by the ways in which all of this brain development takes place. How much do you think parents at this point actually know? I mean, do you think parents are really aware that you can actually change your child's brain over the first 3 years by what you do or what you don't do?
I think that many parents still do not know this. You know, they think it's all a part of growth, and if just nutrition is supplied, that might be enough for the baby. And some people, you know, really, really need to be educated, you know, about how much their role is in the development of their children. And I think those first 3 years, I mean, are really, really very important in a child's life.
Now, Ariva, your youngest child has autism.
Yes.
That has all sorts of different implications for how you interact with a child and teach a child and, you know, how the child develops. When did you notice that there was something different?
Probably around 18 months, I started to notice that he wasn't talking. The social interaction piece that we've been talking about this morning, my son just wasn't engaging. He wouldn't give eye contact to other children or adults, and he separated himself. We would find him in a room by himself playing with toys or lining things up or engaged in all kinds of really what I now know to be repetitive conduct that's very typical of children with autism. At the time, I didn't have the education that the doctor is talking about in terms of noticing, or not necessarily noticing, but knowing what those signs really meant for my child, which I now later learned were all symptoms, very common symptoms of autism.
Dr. Trout, is there something different about the brains of children with autism? I mean, there's so much kind of new research coming out every day, but when we talk about the way that autistic children behave and live in the world, and autism is now being talked about more and more, is it that their brains are different, or what do we think is going on?
We know really very little. We are scratching the surface. You know, at this point, we know that the genes probably play a role, but we do not know which genes. It does run more in families, but again, you know, there is no direct genetic factor. Now, could the environment play a role? Yes, I think there is an environmental factor, but it's not all an environmental factor. I know there has been a lot of news media coverage for vaccinations, and maybe vaccinations may produce it, but then there are millions of children getting vaccinations, and we really don't have a direct cause and effect relationship. So I think there's multiple factors that probably line up, and it appears to be that the male brain is more susceptible. You know, the incidence of autism is much more in males, you know, almost 5 times greater in males as compared to females. You know, there is a special form which is in the pervasive developmental disorder, which is genetically related, called the Rett syndrome, which you see in girls. But the autism is major, much more commonly seen in boys. Now, we do not really know exactly what the causes are for autism.
Now, Areva, we want you to stay with us. We're going to bring in another one of our medical experts. But Dr. Trout, we want to thank you for being with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We were just speaking with Annapurna Trout, chairperson for the Department of Neurology at Howard University Hospital. And now I want to bring Yvette Harris into the conversation. She's an associate professor of psychology at Miami University and author of the book, The African American Child, Development and Challenges. How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
So we have been speaking about the Areva's family, which includes two children who do not have autism or special needs and one child who does. When you think about, let's start with children who don't have any special needs. In the course of your work, what do African American kids really need at early ages to thrive?
I think similarly with other children, they need the stimulation, they need a very secure environment, they need the ability to develop an attachment relationship with a caregiver. So similar with other children, they have those basic needs. They need to feel that they're in a stable environment, an environment that will continually provide for them to allow them to develop a sense of trust with their environment.
But when you specifically have a book that talks about development and challenges, what kind of challenges are you talking about?
I'm talking about challenges such as the health challenges, specifically focusing in on our high infant mortality rate in comparison to other ethnic and racial groups. I'm talking about the specific health challenges that African American children are confronted with, such as sickle cell anemia, lead poisoning, all of those that have a direct impact on their cognitive development as well as their psychosocial emotional development.
Areva, you and your husband are professionals who no doubt are in a position to really be able to apply certain resources, whether it's time or money, to the care of your children, including your son with his special needs around autism. But that doesn't mean that the problem disappears. And you also are working with this special needs network that really tries to help people who don't necessarily have the resources that you might have. Tell us about the work that you're doing with that.
It's very exciting work, and I get really passionate about talking about it because one thing that our organization does, we go into communities where families don't have access to information, they don't have access to resources or to services, and we educate them about the very topics we're talking about this morning, the need to be involved with their children at very young ages, the need to know what the developmental milestones are. Oftentimes, African-American families don't know what to look for in a developing child, so you won't necessarily know that at the age of two, children should be speaking. And so I often see families that come into my organization that are 5 and 6 years old, and the children have no language, and the family hasn't taken any steps to get intervention, to get an evaluation, or to determine what's happening with that child. So Special Needs Network looks to bring that kind of information and those kinds of resources into communities of color, into poor communities, into low-income communities, so that families will know what to look for and how to then access services that can make a tremendous difference in the lives of a developing child.
Professor Harris, in terms of identifying kids who may need some either additional help or some special educational coaching, how's that going broadly in terms of, you know, the African community, African American community? Do you think that people know what to do?
I think there are some people who do know what to do, and those are typically your high resource people. But we're talking about a segment of people who are low resource people and high risk, and you know, live in the most at-risk environments. And that group could be young and teen mothers who probably have limited knowledge about where to seek out services. You know, so therefore, groups like the one that Areva just talked about are so very, very important, especially targeting those young mothers and those poor mothers.
You know, kids, please go ahead.
I was just going to say, we do know statistically that African American and Latino children are often diagnosed with conditions like autism 1 to 2 years later
Absolutely.
Than their typical counterparts. So
yes,
we know that information that our communities so desperately need is not getting into the hands of those parents that can then take some steps to do something about it. So our kids are lagging behind because they're not getting diagnosed timely. Therefore, they're not getting intervention timely.
Absolutely. Professor Harris, give me just 2 or 3 bullet points of things that might be red flags. If your child does or doesn't do blank, you might want to go see a doctor.
Language delay. All right. I think knowledge of developmental timetables, but definitely language delay. And we're talking about, for example, autism, language delay. If your child is not speaking, let's say, comparatively with other children, then you know that might be a red flag for you. If the child has any kind of motor delay or any kind of repetitive behavior, you know that might be a red flag for you.
What on the other hand, are things that you would consider doing for a kid who showed early promise, like an early reader or a kid who was musically gifted?
You mean in terms of...
What should you do in terms, like if you see a kid who's kind of got the ball and running with it, what do you do with that kid?
Oh, if it's a kid who's got a particular leaning toward reading, then you keep stimulating that, you know? You keep encouraging them you provide them with the opportunities to develop those more advanced reading kinds of skills.
Now, Ariva, we only have a little bit of time, but what have you learned from being a mother to children with different perspectives on growth?
Well, what I've learned as both a mother, a lawyer, and an advocate for children is that all children are different. They're all so incredibly special. And no matter if your child has a language delay or your child is gifted, as that child who's an avid reader, that we as parents play such a critical role in nurturing that child. And when we embrace that role as being the final arbiters of how our children will develop, that we can see our children just make incredible progress.
I want to thank both of you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ariva Martin is a lawyer and advocate for special needs and disabled children in underserved communities. She was here with us at our NPR West studios. And Yvette Harris is an associate professor of psychology at Miami University and author of the book, The African American Child Development and Challenges. She spoke with us from the studios at member station WBUM at Miami University.